Okay. Let's go.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Paula Reet, Mayor of Kingborough, and it's my pleasure to welcome everyone to tonight's council meeting on Monday, the 1st of July, 2024, and a very warm welcome to those members of the community who are in the public gallery this evening, and also to those people who are watching along at home. Being 5:30 p.m, I now officially declare this meeting open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website. Council meetings are also live streamed on YouTube, and in accordance with Council's policy, I'll ask the CEO to confirm that the audio recording has started. Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reet, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. From our staff this evening, we have the CEO, Mr Stewart, the Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, the Director of Engineering Services, Mr Reeve, the Director of Environment Development and Community Services, Ms Shakuti, the Manager of Development Services, Ms Tyler Moore, our Statutory Planner, Ms KC, our Media and Communications Advisor, Ms Adams, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton. We don't have any apologies this evening. We're now on page one of the agenda. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 11, held on the 17th of June 2024, be confirmed as a true record. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Bain. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Workshops held since the last Council meeting. There were no workshops held since the meeting on the 17th of June. We're now at declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration they would like to declare? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Just declaring in regards to 16.1 Copping Refuse Disposal Site Joint Authority proposed rule changes that I am the Kingborough Council's proxy, so you'll see me in those minutes. So upon the advice of the General Manager, I'm just declaring that fact, but I'll remain in the room.
Thank you very much. Any further declarations of conflict of interest? Thank you. Page two, still transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from closed into open session or open into closed session? Thank you. Questions without notice from the public. Is there any member of the public who would like to ask a question without notice this evening? No? Thank you very much. Questions on notice from the public. The questions taken on notice by Mr Charlie Biggins at the council meeting on the 17th of June 2024 in relation to LUPA and other legislation, tree removal, tree bylaw and tree bylaw statutory time limitations will be provided at a future council meeting due to time constraints. And if members of the community do wish to submit a question on notice, they can do so by completing the relevant form on Council's website or by emailing kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. Which takes us to questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? No? Thank you. Still on page two, questions on notice from councillors. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. So the open session of council now adjourns at 6:35 p.m. and the planning authority commences at 5:00. That was an hour of our lives we just missed. Beg your pardon. Open session of council adjourns at 5:35 p.m. and planning authority commences at 5:35 p.m. We're on page three now. Officers' reports to planning authority, DA 2024 number 20, development application for dwelling, ancillary dwelling and two shipping containers at 39 Hollyhock Drive, Kingston, with a recommendation on page 19. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Gladewright and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you, Mayor. I met with the neighbour of the subject site, who's clearly very distressed about this proposal, and I understand that she spent a lot of time writing very detailed submissions and looking at this very, very carefully. So I do have a number of questions because I do want to feel assured that we are approving this with no doubt that it meets the requirements of the scheme. So I do have a number of questions, please. In the background section of the report, it is stated that the proposal is considered unusual. Can you explain why that word has been used to describe it?
Through you, Mayor, the word unusual is just placed in there, unusual in the development pattern in the area where houses tend to be three or four bedroom houses. It's not unusual in its built form insofar as being double storey, that's typical for an urban area, but the number of bedrooms and en-suites and storage is something slightly different than we would typically see within these areas.
How many times have the plans been amended and resubmitted?
Through you, Mayor. The plans, the amended plans were resubmitted after the advertising date was over, but the actual amendment was also done in accordance with the further information response requested from the applicant. So we did ask further information. So the initial plans went complying with the building envelope clause and a few of the other requirements in the scheme, so we did ask the applicant to demonstrate compliance or to demonstrate compliance with the performance criteria of the acceptable solutions of the scheme, and they did come back with the second amended plans, which were then advertised accordingly, and the third amended plans were provided following the exhibition period was over. Yep.
Thank you. On page 17, it talks about some covenants. It says that council is not a party to this covenant. Can you just explain that a little bit more to me?
Through you, Mayor. The covenants have been applied after it's gone through council, so they're effectively what we call private covenants. So they're not endorsed by council. So council can apply covenants to land, which we've seen in the chamber, obviously, whether that is protection of an area or a waterway, or it might be a certain design or development or restrictions. Where council is a party, and so Kingborough Council is named in that. These particular covenants were applied after the, as part of the subdivision before the titles were released, but after it's gone through council, so we're not a party to them. They do exist, they are a valid covenant insofar as that the titles office have applied them to the titles, but we have no jurisdiction over them to enforce them, unlike if we were a party to those covenants.
Thank you.
Deputy Mayor.
The zone purpose statements talk about respecting the local character of an area. Hollyhock Drive has mostly single-storey dwellings, and you did mention that this proposal is unusual because it's not single-storey. How can we say that the zone purpose is achieved with this proposed development?
Through you, Mayor. Sorry, just to correct that, I didn't say it was unusual because it was double-storey. That was one point I said didn't make it unusual, it was more about the population. When looking at neighbourhood character, you need to look more broadly. There's also the zone provisions within the planning scheme don't hold a lot of weight for assessment unless there's a particular clause within that zoning that sends you back to that neighbourhood character assessment or the preferred statements, and it provides limitations around built form, that setbacks, height and so forth, setbacks from boundaries, and they are required to be assessed as acceptable solutions for performance criteria. So it's not, the character isn't really picked up within the provisions of the planning scheme to be assessed against.
Okay, thank you. With 10.4.3, it says a dwelling must have private open space that includes an area capable of serving as an extension of the dwelling for outdoor relaxation, dining, entertaining and children's play. The private open space is right in line of the nature strip. How can this be considered private open space? Is there a fence that is proposed that would make it private? How can we see this area as being a space that could be used for relaxation or children's play, for example?
Through you, Mayor, the term private open space is that it is private, it's not public. It doesn't mean secluded private open space. Other jurisdictions have a difference between the two, secluded being that you can't see into it, that you would expect a fence, but under the Tasmanian provisions within the interim planning schemes, there's no requirement to be fenced. And no assessment about whether you can see into that area or not, and the people, we can't assume that they won't enjoy sitting in their front yard for recreational purposes.
Right on the footpath?
It's next to the footpath.
And it's considered suitable for children's play?
Through you, Mayor, the provisions of the planning scheme talk about it being suitable for children's play, related back to the acceptable solution to do with the dimensions and the area and the location, but it doesn't prohibit it being in front open space. It does require to go in performance criteria, so you're limited by the wording, the performance criteria, which is provided in the table on page 9 of the report.
Okay, thank you. In regards to 10.4.6, privacy for all dwellings, it has been explained that the upper storey bedrooms will look out over the top of the next door house, which is single storey, and that this neighbouring property has their private open space on the other side of their house, which will therefore remain private. But what about the fact that people can look from the bedrooms of that second storey down into the windows of the neighbouring single storey house? How is that then complying with 10.4.6?
Through you, Mayor, the, as included in the report on pages 10 and 11 are the provisions about overlooking into those spaces. So the overlooking provisions talk about a 3-metre setback, which it is within. The overlooking, and this have regard to the windows, but considering the plane at which it's at, the angle that you are to be able to look out, you can't look straight down and in, it's just not possible. So you look at it at an angle. Also, if there's eaves within that roof space, that has potential to block some of that overlooking. And the open space it's referred to is, I believe, beyond 11 metres from that window. So the planning scheme, unfortunately, is fairly limited to its 3 metres, but once you go to the performance criteria, it doesn't give you the distance, but it was considered in the assessment that it met the performance criteria, noting that there is a planning permit condition recommended to screen two of those windows. If there was further concern, there is possibility to require screening of other windows as well.
Well, my next question is, why then are only two of the 7 windows along there proposed to have screening and not all of them?
Ms. Tullamore. Ms. Casey.
Through you, Mayor. Not all the 7 windows are the habitable room windows. Only the 4 of the windows are the habitable room windows to the bedrooms. Window 13 and window 14 to bedroom 2 and bedroom 3, where we did discuss with the applicant about the opportunities to mend and screen those windows as well, but then the applicant did agree to only screen those 2 windows which were directly apparent to overlooking issues from the habitable room windows to the adjoining property's private open space, and also by screening window 17 and 18, it's actually minimising the impact directly overlooking to the private open space and rest of the backyard of the adjoining property. Yeah.
I know I moved this motion, so I'm unable to move an amendment, but I'd just like to foreshadow if anyone else wanted to propose an amendment that all of the windows are screened, I would support it. I do have a couple more questions though. Can you explain what that screening is exactly? Like, what? How is it screened?
Well, the screening requirement in the scheme, it requires that the screening to the window is to be no less than 1.7 metres minimum from the finished floor level of the upper level. So it has to be from the finished floor level above up to 1.7 metres of the window, so that part of the window will be screened.
And what is the screening? Is it like a stick-on, or is it a lattice, or what?
It could be timber, or it could be cladding or things like that, but we don't have any specific details of the screening. But all they have mended on the plans was to show that the screening will be added, but we'll ask, we have edit condition in the permit that they show proper screening inclusion in the building plans as well. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Deputy Mayor.
Is student accommodation allowed at this site?
Through you, Mayor. Yes, can you repeat a question, please?
Is student accommodation allowed at this site?
through you, Mayor, yes, the student accommodation or boarding house or commercial, sorry, boarding house or communal residence is also allowed in the zoning, but it could, it may be permitted use or discretionary use assessment. Yep.
If this building is rented out to a number of different people, would that be allowed? Who aren't one family, if there are a number of different strangers, for example?
Through you, Mayor, the planning scheme isn't overly definitive on this. There are different definitions about what a boarding house is or a dwelling. It doesn't say a single dwelling can't have multiple people living in a house. Obviously, you have situations where, say, you have a teenager from another family not getting on with their family and they're staying at the house and they may or may not be paying rent towards that. You may have extended family in your house. It might be your uncles, aunts, and extended family for that. There are many instances where there are share houses throughout Australia, probably throughout the world really, where you have multiple people from different families or different groups of people not related to one another that live together, that is commonplace. There is a definition about a boarding house in the planning scheme, but not communal house, and there's no definition or reference to share house. So it's a bit loose, to be honest, on whether you can have different people paying. It doesn't say anything about paying towards that. When there is a use, we have to find the closest definition. So if it was clearly run as something else, then we would define that. The question was asked, assuming that you're taking it from the representations, the question was asked to the applicant of their intended use of the house and did raise a question about whether it was a use other than a single dwelling, and the applicant has come back confirming that it's a single dwelling.
Thank you. So if we are to assume that there were six adults living at this property and there were six cars, three cars are allowed to be parked on site and the other three would be on the street, is there any issue with that?
Through you, Mayor, the planning scheme specifies parking rates under E6 under the codes for a single dwelling is required to have the two parking spaces.
So the additional cars on the street, is there any issue with that?
It just is required to meet the requirements of the planning scheme, which is two parking spaces. The occurrence of additional cars and houses occurs at the time, whether there's people here that have got teenage children or young adult children that just won't move out. Yes, you can end up in a situation where you have multiple cars. It's commonplace and probably ever increasing, but the planning scheme doesn't control that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so I feel very concerned about the privacy elements, and I feel like all seven windows should be screened. So again, if anyone wanted to move that, I'd support it. Thank you.
Before I go to the next speaker, can I just ask a question, since Ms. Tylermore touched on it, in relation to the definition of a boarding house? What is the definition under the Act for a boarding house?
Through you, Mayor, under the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015, the definition of boarding house, which is written by the state government, means the use of land for a dwelling in which lodgers rent one or more rooms, generally for extended periods, and some parts of the dwelling are shared by all lodgers. There's also a definition for communal residence.
Yep.
Just to round it out.
Yeah, sure.
Means use of the land for a building to accommodate persons who are unrelated to one another and who share some parts of the building. Examples include a boarding house, residential college and residential care home.
So the definition of a boarding house that you've just read out from the Act sounds quite vague. So how do you differentiate a boarding house then from something assessed as general residential, if you're only relying on the advice of the applicant that this is intended to be a residential property? you know, that, that houses a large family versus potentially, I don't know, individual rooms being rented out with shared communal areas, which is just the definition of the boarding house. Is that sort of a subjective assessment then?
We've asked the question directly of the applicant and they have replied that it's a single dwelling. There's no definition in single dwelling that limits how many bathrooms or bedrooms or living areas that you have. We know definitely there's diversity of housing types and layouts of houses and so forth, so there's no limitation on that to suggest it. If there was, the recommendation includes a condition to say that it must still meet the definition of single dwelling. If it was to merge into something else, then that would be an enforcement matter, but we can't make a decision on an untrust of an applicant's word of what the proposal is. So we need to assess what's provided to us.
Thank you. What would be the situation if it was assessed as a boarding house, if the applicant had come and said, I'm putting this in, it's not general residential, it's going to operate as a boarding house, it's not going to be a family home, what would the situation be with this application with that categorisation?
If the applicant, if any applicant for land in general residential zone wanted to apply for a boarding house or communal house, it would be a discretionary application, so that means it needs a planning permit from council and it has to go through the public exhibition process, the same as this, and the consideration would be on that, noting that under the general residential zone there are no assessment criteria for discretionary uses, unhelpfully. So it would still receive the same assessment. The difference would be the car parking requirements under E6. So yes, they could apply for it. Yes, there is a potential that it could be approved. It also would have consideration about possibility of not being approved, but it has to be limited by the requirements of the planning scheme.
And so, okay, so had, just sort of tying that together with the comments by the Deputy Mayor, so had it been, if you don't accept the advice of the applicant that it is a general residential development that is going to be a family home, albeit I would have to say a very large extended family, or the Von Trapp family are going to be living there because that is a large number of bedrooms, then it would have come, you could have had the option of rejecting that and said, no, it's a boarding house. We believe it is going to be a boarding house, but it would still go through the same process, but the car parking would be an issue. Is that correct?
The car parking assessment would be different, yes.
And the car parking assessment would require
further parking.
One parking space per room, bedroom, or?
No, it's one per three licensed room. Now, the definition of licensed room is something else that we'd have to look at because that's not defined in the planning scheme. And it talks about one space for staff member. It doesn't say whether the staff member lives on site or doesn't live on site. I think really it's been written with a university college type thing in mind, and it hasn't covered it all, so it's not entirely clear. We'd be up to interpretation, but there would be additional car parking required, I expect.
Okay, thank you. I can see other lights starting to come on, so I'll leave that there. I've got some more questions later. Councillor Street.
Yeah, look, I just have a question leading on from the Mayor's line of inquiry. One of the difficulties that I had in looking at this and considering it was the Mayor asked, well, if the applicant had said it's a boarding house, what difference would it have made? I couldn't see that it made any difference. I'm wondering whether you can speak to whether or not the fact that the applicant might have said this is intended to be a boarding house or a communal residence would necessarily have taken it out of the definition of single dwelling, or whether they operate together.
Yeah, it is very... I thought it was just me because my ears are still blocked from being unwell, but it's very...
Am I mumbling?
No, I was having trouble hearing you. I turn my volume up as well. Can everyone in the public gallery hear us okay? No? Okay. There's a one and a maybe. We might just all need to project our voices a little bit more. I apologise. Okay. I've been unwell, so my voice is a bit quieter than normal, but I'm also having trouble hearing.
Councillor Richardson just pointed out to me that I'm probably whispering because I'm trying not to wake the fictional baby that's at home at the minute. The question was, the difficulty that I had with the proposition that maybe it is boarding houses, that I didn't see that that made any difference, because I couldn't see how that would take it out of being a single dwelling in any event. Is my reasoning on that at all sound?
Through you, Mayor, if the applicant doesn't want a boarding house, they're not going to apply for a boarding house.
I suppose my point is, I couldn't see that even if they had said this is a boarding house, it would have made any difference because it's still a single dwelling. Is that...
Through you, Mayor, no, that's not correct. The use class is residential.
Mm.
So single dwelling is one type of residential. Boarding house is one type of residential. Communal is one type of residential and others. So it would still be residential. It's just that it's a discretionary use. So residential single dwelling is a... Sorry, this is going to be...
Planning 101. Back to level 10, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so residential, in general residential zones, this general residential zone, is ordinarily a no permit required use. That doesn't mean it's exempt, it just means it doesn't need a planning permit. If you do not satisfy all the building provisions in that, or the acceptable solutions, then you lose your status as no permit required and you go to discretionary. So if it was a single dwelling. So this one doesn't meet all the requirements because of the open space and the windows. So it became a discretionary application. If it was applied for as a boarding house, if that's what the applicant wanted, because they've said that that's not what they don't want that, but if they did, it could be applied for and we would do the assessment, because if you go to the clause under, if you go to general residential zone, there's no particular clause that says discretionary uses, you must comply with these things. In other zones, if there's discretionary uses, there's particular clauses they put in there, like hours of operation, lighting, transport, those sorts of things. In the general residential zone, they gave us discretionary uses but then gave us no tools to assess it against. Mm. So, yes, you're correct. The assessment would be the same because we'd still be doing the built form criteria on that. The difference would be the car parking assessment.
Yes. It's really the only difference is the car parking and access code at the end of the
correct.
Yep. Thanks.
Further contributions, Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
No, it's not even very clear on mine. I have a few questions, and I want to thank the Deputy Mayor for basically asking 90% of my questions. but that's okay. Page 11. At the top of the page, there is the performance criteria box. And there is a proposal, and there's a commentary about the proposal. It has three paragraphs. The first refers to bedrooms W13 and 14, and that they don't demonstrate compliance. And then we move on to 17 and 18 on the next paragraph. And I'm trying to understand if I'm reading this right. So there seems to be the need for screening for 17 and 18. Are 13 and 14 not compliant for what reason, and why is there not a solution that I can read for them? Or is that an error? Is there some sort of an error maybe? Does that make sense, or am I making it worse?
Through you, Mayor. Thank you for the question. Window 13 and 14, which are to bedroom 2 and bedroom 3 of the upper
yep.
level windows, they are considered not to be directly overlooking to the private open space or the rest of the backyard of the adjoining property. And also, the amended plans were received screening the windows 17 and 18, which reduced or minimised the impact, the privacy impact on the adjoining properties. We did initially discuss with the applicant about the opportunity to screen all these windows, but applicant came back and screened two of the windows, which were windows 17 and 18, which were considered apparently or directly overlooking to the private open space of the adjoining block.
If I may continue,
thank you. Thank you, Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. So the windows 13 and 14, are they the ones that look over the rooftop of the dwelling next door? Is that correct?
Well, all the upper level windows are not directly overlooking on the habitable rooms of the adjoining block. They're actually overlooking on the roof, being considering the adjoining block has single-storey dwelling, it's actually overlooking on the roof and not their habitable space.
So if they're all overlooking the roof, why is there screening required on 17 and 18? Or is that on a different side of the house?
Through you, Mayor. The representatives had raised concern that these windows were overlooking on the private open space and their backyard where the children would play or have opportunity to play or use as the private open space. So the negotiation was done with the applicant to screen all these windows, and the applicant came back mending these two windows and screening these two windows as they were considered to be directly overlooking the private open space of the adjoining block and not the window 13 and 14.
Okay, so is it fair to say that the applicant does not have problems with windows 13 and 14? Does not?
Through you, Mir, we didn't consider that applicant didn't have any problems with windows 13 and 14. It was assessed against the performance criteria and it was deemed adequate to comply with the performance criteria.
Because I have received representation that this paragraph confuses them, and it does actually confuse me, because they seem to have an issue with windows 13 and 14 as well as 17 and 18, but 13 and 14 have no rectification. And they claim that they've actually lodged that representation separately as part of the consideration of the planning authority. So my question is, if you've taken into account 17 and 18, why haven't you also taken into account 13 and 14, which is part of their complaint, which may justify the amendment the Deputy Mayor asked, that all windows on that side of the house should be screened?
Through you, Mayor, we did discuss with the applicant again, and they came back with amended plans just to screen those two windows. Window 13 and 14 were considered not to be directly overlooking, but also there is an opportunity to amend the condition if need be.
Councillor Antoli.
That contradicts correspondence that we received this afternoon from one of the applicants. So I'd love one of my colleagues, who maybe is a little less pressured for time, to maybe address that. I have some more questions, if I may.
Thank you.
Page 12, at the top of the page. And maybe this is actually the answer to my question. Yeah, this is actually a direct quote from one of the applicants. Nothing has been done to bedroom W13 and W14 to minimise direct views into our habitable rooms, namely our study, which is currently a baby change area, and our kitchen dining room. So that's a direct quote from correspondence received today from the applicant next door, which to me indicates that 13 and 14 have not been taken into account, even though 17 and 18 have. So the applicant has made an ambit claim on all the windows, and you've said yes to two but not to the others, and I'm just trying to understand the reason why.
Ms. Casey.
Through you, Mayor, it's not that it wasn't considered. It was considered, and it was the applicant were asked whether they were able to screen all these windows. But the answer was received that since these two windows are not directly overlooking on the habitable room space and also only partly overlooking on the private open space, they would rather just screen those two directly apparent windows and not the window 13 and 14. It was discussed with the applicant following the exhibition period to receive the amended plans, and that was agreed between the applicant and us that the windows 17 and 18 be screened to reduce the impact on the private open space of the adjoining block.
Okay. I'll keep asking my questions. Page 13, 2.5.5, where we talk about visual impact. There's complaints mentioned a covenant B on the subdivision, which is not does not permit transportable or removable structures to be allowed on the property. Is that correct, or is that to do with the covenant that you mentioned earlier, Ms. Tyler Moore, that's not enforceable?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, it's the covenant that was put on afterwards, and we're not a party to it.
So it's a misunderstanding of how enforceable that is. Okay, thank you. And I had a question around screening, around shading, I beg your pardon. Page 10. There's a comment made just above the general residential zone, clause 10.4.6. So it's about half, right underneath the diagram, there's a dot point and there's a commentary, and halfway through the commentary it reads thus: the adjoining property dwelling contains a single-storey house that will not impact these areas by the reduction in sunlight. Therefore, it is considered that the POS is reasonably oriented to the northwest. In other words, it's saying the next-door neighbour won't shade the POS, therefore it's in an okay place. So there is consideration given to where it's positioned based on the shading next door, but there doesn't seem to be the same consideration given back to the neighbour about shading on their property from the entire dwelling. It doesn't seem to be taken as into account. And one of the submissions to us was that they were told by council officers that if this is approved, the shading issue is not going to be taken into account. And I don't understand what that means. The shading issue is part of take it into account. The shading issue, they seem to have provided for us documentation and diagrams that show that the majority of their home will be shaded for the majority of the day, which of course includes the solar panels.
Through you, Mayor. I believe you're talking about two different properties. So the property to the north won't be overshadowed by this proposal because it's to the north, and the way the sun falls, you don't get shadows that go north. The property that's to the south of the subject site will receive some overshadowing, but because the proposal meets the building envelope, which is the one that goes up to a certain height, has to go in at 45 degrees at a certain height, then we don't have the opportunity to assess the overshadowing.
Right, so you're saying that overshadowing is not part of your selection criteria or performance criteria, is that what you're saying?
Overshadowing does form part of the planning scheme requirements, but if you meet the building envelope requirements, then it doesn't trigger us to because you've met the acceptable solution.
Yeah.
So we don't have the ability to assess the overshadowing.
So while they may have a legitimate concern, it's not something you can do much about within the scheme. Okay, thank you for advising me on that. I want to put an amendment about the screening, but I think I need a little bit more information as to how enforceable it is over windows 13 and 14, given that they look over the roof and not apparently into a window. The neighbour feels it does, and I haven't been there, haven't physically stood in front of their window and looked at it to verify it, but I think I'd be leaning towards supporting it, but I'm not confident enough to lodge the amendment right now. That's all from me, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. A lot of the questions, as Councillor Antoli said, have already been asked. I was going to comment on the overshadowing, but that's been mentioned. With the private open space, I totally agree with the Deputy Mayor. It's unusual to me for a five-bedroom house to have such a small amount of private open space. At the front of the house, there's barely any windows where you can see out of the front of the house. It's on the main road through Whitewater Park Estates, noting that they've got a covenant there for no front fences. So to me, it doesn't seem private or safe, but as we've been told, that could be considered. And just on the privacy clause, I'm interested to know, from the neighbour's perspective, who determines what their private open space is? Which part of their property is private open space?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the private open space, we would lean towards the requirements of the planning scheme of what they define private open space, so the main area, the main open area that a person recreates in. If they were to suggest that the 1.5 metre setback from the fence was their private open space, we'd struggle to agree that it was their primary private open space. So the backyard area, if you've had the opportunity to go to the site or look at the aerial images of these properties, the property to the north, you know, it's clearly sitting on the northern side, which makes so much sense for them because it's on the north and you want direct sunlight. So that's what we regard as their private open space, that whole area.
Okay, so just another question through you, Mayor. Could, given we're determining that this development's private open space is at the front of their house, is there any reason why the neighbour's private open space couldn't also be the front of their house then?
Through you, Mayor, the residents could say that their private open space is in the front yard. I don't know that there's a lot to gain from it. If it's with respect to those two windows that are closer to the front of the house. I mean, the open space, if you've seen the site of that neighbouring property, does sort of extend that whole boundary. It's not just limited to the back part. So it is a possibility to apply a condition that all upper-level windows on the northern elevation be provided with screening to protect those views, with a determination that it didn't meet the performance criteria without that. That is possible to put it on. Just sort of following on from the last comment by Councillor Anatoly, what are the risks with that? The risks would be that the applicant may choose to appeal the condition. It's up to the applicant whether they're going to go to that extent for that. Will they win it at appeal? It's not a really easily defined outcome or non-compliance with the performance criteria, so there's certainly no certainty about whether they would win or not win and whether they'd have a desire to really go to a full appeal just for that or not. And the same is for the residents. The residents can appeal the outcome of the permit, whether that is the particular conditions or the overall decision as well.
Okay, but just to clarify, at the moment they don't meet the criteria because they're within 3 metres of that boundary.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, they don't meet the acceptable solution. So if you don't meet the acceptable solution, then you roll over to having to assess against the performance criteria. And the performance criteria doesn't have any quantitative numbers in it, such as particular setbacks. It's those ones that are written in the report under that assessment part on page 10 and 11. So mainly the bit that says performance criteria P2, and it describes it in there.
Councillor Bain.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I would definitely be supportive of the condition being added that all the four bedroom windows of that side have screening on them, because I think it will impact the neighbour. I think you will be able to see into their rooms, and it would also reflect an issue with privacy for when they're playing. If they want to play down the side boundary, which is closest to the development, if they want to play at the front of their residence, then I think their privacy should be respected. And given it's within 3 metres, I'll be supportive of that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Next, I've got Councillor Cordova, and then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. So I have prepared an amendment regarding the screening, but before we get to that, my first question is regarding an amendment to screen everything. Firstly, these are north-facing windows. So what would be the impact on passive solar and energy efficiency for the house? Will enforcing a condition on requiring screening, even though I think we've... Would a condition like that impact passive solar? And are these screens... I know they're undefined, but are they... Will they let light in? My first question.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, there's a whole variety of different screens that can be used. So some of the options typically would be they have a high sill window, which is just means your window doesn't start to 1.7 metres because the average person can't see out that. Yes, we have people that are that tall, but their eyes are not at the top of their head, it's set down. So that's an Australian standard for that. The another alternative is use obscure glazing, where they use something like bubble glass or other all sorts of treatments that you can have, so glass, bubble glass, which means you can't see through it, but it lets all the natural light in, so you could have that for the full length down to the floor. Another alternative is to put screening on the windows, and you could do some... So it can't have more than 25% transparency, so you can't see through more 25% of it. So you could have battens across there. So there's different batten types. Typically what gets used is wooden battens with gaps between that don't equal more than 25% for the width and length of the window, Or you could have louvers. Louvers can be used where there's still more view gained of the sky, as an example, because you've got to think of the amenity within the rooms. So if the louvers are tipped up like that, you can't see downward towards them, but you can still see up to the sky. And they only need to do it to 1.7 metres, so from 1.7 metres they can keep it clear glass. It's important to make sure that the windows aren't sliding open windows where you then slide open your whole window and look out. Those windows aren't very often installed these days. They're more likely to be the wind-out ones, which only have a limitation of how far they can go. Or there's other sort of screens, whether it's like cut mesh that you put on the outside. So, yes, there are alternatives to allow good solar access into the dwelling, but in saying that, the planning scheme doesn't give any regard to energy efficiency of your house, disappointingly. It would need to be addressed under the building permit.
Thank you. So through you, Mayor, I guess, so my final question before moving this amendment is just, in the opinion of the staff, would a condition requiring, as we've heard from many councillors, would a condition requiring the screening of all those windows be a reasonable condition to add to this recommendation by way of amendment? A lot of councillors have suggested it, but in the opinion of the staff, would that be a reasonable step for us to take?
And through you, Mayor, as per the assessment, we believe that the requiring of the two is the two that are mentioned in the condition are the most important ones to be screened. Acknowledge that the performance criteria is not very quantitative. I think there is room for interpretation that the others should be screened, so I don't think it would be completely unreasonable to have a condition that would screen all those windows.
Thank you. So through you, Mayor, I'd like to move the amendment that I've provided to staff previously. So basically it says...
Does Mrs. Morton have the amendment?
Mrs. Morton has a copy of the amendment. So the thrust of this amendment is that it will require screening of, including the other windows, W13 and W14, but the exact wording is very lengthy. Should we read it all out? Is it best for me to read it out? Yep, okay. The proposed amendment. Number one, delete condition one in the recommendation and replace it with the following. Before the approved development commences, amended plans to the satisfaction and approval of the manager development services must be submitted to and approved. When approved, the plans will be endorsed and will then form part of this permit. The plans must be generally in accordance with the plans P1 and P2 submitted on 14 May 2024 and 11 June 2024 and must demonstrate. Number one, installation of privacy treatment to all upper level windows on the northern elevation, brackets including W13, W14, W17 and W18, as shown on the advertised plans, end bracket, with the inclusion of, number one, permanently fixed external screens for the full width of the windows to a height of not less than 1.7 metres above floor level, with a uniform transparency of not more than 25%, or, number two, achieve a sill height of not less than 1.7 metres above the floor level, or, number three, have fixed obscure glazing extending to a height of not less than 1.7 metres above the floor level. Number two, landscape plan in accordance with permit condition five. Except as otherwise required by this permit, use and development of the land must be substantially in accordance with the endorsed plans or reports. This permit relates to the use of land or buildings irrespective of the applicant or subsequent occupants, and whoever acts on it must comply with all conditions in this permit. Any amendment, variation or extension of this permit requires further planning consent of council. Does that sound about right? So that's the... That's
Thank
the
you.
Amendment.
Okay, I need a seconder for the amendment. Do I have a seconder for the amendment? Thank you. And I actually should have asked whether it was acceptable. Let's go back a step. Is the amendment acceptable to the mover and the seconder of the motion? That's the easy way to do it. Okay. All right, so the amendment now becomes part... We don't have to vote on the amendment. The amendment now becomes part of the substantive motion. Councillor Cordova, did you want to continue?
Thank you, Mayor. I'll be brief because I don't want to editorialise this beyond what's already been put in this comprehensive report, except to acknowledge the significant, angst or the significant concern that's been raised with us about the unusual, in the sense that this is a larger house and it has two shipping containers and an ancillary dwelling. I've noted the community concern around this proposal. I think where there has been compromise so far with regards to this is, for example, on page 12 where it says the site coverage was reduced on the amended plans, reducing the number of shipping containers from 3 to 2. There's been lengthy discussion about screening. There have been a number of, for want of a better term, compromises made so far. But the reality is that the situation, as I see it, is that we have a development application for a proposal that does fit within the planning scheme. It does fit within, you know, we've had these discussions about the building envelope and the private covenants, the impacts on traffic, the privacy, private open space and screening concerns. To me, as it did say in the comments section on page 12, all the submissions lodged have raised issues with the intended use from the proposal. All the submissions lodged have raised issues with the intended use from the proposal is not for a single dwelling, end quote. That is, in a sense, a speculation about what the intended use of this dwelling is, but I guess I just need to reiterate that we need to assess this proposal on its merits. We can't really speculate. If it were to be used for a use that was not permitted, then that would trigger enforcement actions. So really we need to, I believe, assess this against the planning scheme and it complies. That's what the recommendation is. And then we need to acknowledge that if this premises is then used for something that is not permitted, we acknowledge that there would be enforcement action on that. You know, if that was a concern that was raised to us. So I'm saying we can't really speculate on what we think might be done with this. What this application is for and what this permit would be for is a very prescribed and specific set of circumstances. And it wouldn't be right to go beyond that by speculating on what we think the hidden agenda or motive may or may not be. That's not our place. Our place is to judge this against the planning scheme, which is what I'm certainly doing. So my final comment is going to be that on page 15 where it says council cannot enforce implementation of better design elements to improve the visual impact, end quote. I think that's an important quote because really it may not be to all of our tastes, but if it fits within the planning scheme, it's important that the planning authority allows what is allowed within the planning scheme. And secondly, on page 12 where it talks about this is a single dwelling that they're asking for, and it's the theory here is that it says the issue of the intended use of the building was raised with the applicant in further information request letter. Their response advised that the use intended is purely for residential purpose/family home and not for commercial purposes. So that's what I'm judging this on. I'm judging this on it being a residential house in a general residential zone. I'm not judging it on whether or not it's going to be used for commercial purposes because it's not allowed to be used for commercial purposes. That's not what the permit would allow. So that's why I'm pleased that we've been able to at least put in this the window treatments, the privacy treatments. I think that that's a good step in the right direction. I realise that this is not to everybody's taste and I realise that there's community concern around it, but it fits within the planning scheme, so I'll be supporting it. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I've just reminded that I forgot to ask some questions about the shipping containers. There was a lot of concern around the visual impact that it has on the neighbours. Has any screening around? I've missed it, but if I have, forgive me. Is there any screening that has been put in place for the shipping containers so that they are not an eyesore to the neighbours?
Through you, Mayor. No, there's no screening proposed. The shipping containers are considered as just an outbuilding, so the same as a shed.
Yep.
So there wouldn't normally be a requirement for screening in that particular instance, unless it didn't meet the acceptable solution, which it does meet the acceptable solution, or if there was a particular reason. So we're fairly limited on being able to address that.
And we could argue that the visual impact of a shed differs greatly to the visual impact of a dirty big Mediterranean shipping company container that might be rusty and red. There is a big difference between the two. Can we agree on that?
It's up to personal preference. I have no opinion about whether one's better or worse.
So what discretion do we have to put to enjoin screening around those shipping containers or some form of condition around visual impact, painting it so that it can't be a rusty old shipping container or cladding around it? What discretion do we have to minimise that visual impact? Because if I was the neighbour and I saw two big shipping containers glaring over me over the fence adjoining, that would be a problem. And I reckon that would really actually impact the value of my home.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, as I just previously said, it is considered as an outbuilding. It complies with the setback requirements of the planning scheme, so there's no reason that we could really justify requiring treatment of that building on the site. And it's subjective as to whether people think it's attractive or unattractive, or whether a zinc loom shed, as an example, would be worse than what is proposed.
So I've talked to residents on Bruny Island who've been told to change the colour of the shed and to paint it in a different colour so that it matches the environment. Why can't we require the same thing of the shipping containers?
Through you, Mayor, the reason for other properties where it may be required is because of other zonings. Or there's overlay controls on the site, such as the scenic landscape code. So there's a whole range of different reasons why shipping containers may need treatment. But in this instance, it's in a general residential area, it's considered an outbuilding, and there's no provisions within the assessment clauses to be able to control the appearance of those buildings.
So you're saying that we can't add anything to it to enforce that on the owner, is that correct? Or if we did, it would probably be lost at TASCAT.
Through you, Mayor, I wouldn't recommend applying condition on there. I don't think there's reasonable planning justification to be able to put it on there. If the councillors were of a mind to put a condition of that like at the tribunal, I don't think there'd be a very strong case at all, and I don't think it's likely to be upheld. But, of course, that's subject to decision of TASCAT.
Can we put in there as a recommendation then? A request to the owner? Because let's face it, folks, it's ugly to have a dirty big two shipping containers right next door to you overlooking your fence. And I think there should be some form of discretion from my peers here to take that into consideration to get this over the line, but to minimise the impact. Because reading the room, the energy in this room is, if we had full discretion, is not very favourable towards this application. So we're trying to make this work for council so that it's not lost in court, but also for the community.
Through you, Mayor, the councillors could elect to put an advice clause on the in the advice clauses that are provided in the recommendation, but it's not enforceable. As an advice clause, it'd have to be a condition to be enforceable.
Okay. How do I, unless I've got a better offer or idea from my peers, how do we add that in? Is that an amendment? Or what advice do you give me?
It would be an amendment, so perhaps it would be preferable if it was drafted by our staff so that the wording is correct. So if there are other speakers, perhaps we could go to other contributions while that is done. Can that work, Ms. Tullamore?
If you'd like me to answer any more questions, it's very hard to answer questions and write conditions.
Somebody might like to speak, just not ask questions. Anybody?
So we'll swing back to that.
Yep.
We'll be okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. If you can possibly just speak.
I'll speak just
Councillor Dean.
To echo pretty much. Forgive me too, because I'm coming in the back of the sickness as well. My voice is somewhat gone. Everything that's been said in this room, I think, as Councillor Antolio's probably mentioned, is felt by all of us around our concerns. It's pretty clear that it is an unusual application. It's pretty clear that they have squeezed out every last square metre of this block to the advantage of maximising their occupancy. They've put in far more bathrooms than is probably what is expected. They've put in a double story house in an area which is clearly single story as usual, but Councillor Cotover made some fortunately excellent points that we can only assess this against the scheme And whilst reading this over the weekend and today, they're just, it surprises me, I suppose, to some degree, that there are only two, out of this whole application, there are only two areas which are actually discretionary for us to consider. And that was the public open space, and what was the second one? My mind's gone blank. Private, and we've done our best to rectify the window situation. As Councillor Baines pointed out, you know, those of us with young families, or just anyone, can see that having open space on the busy road without a fence that is literally the absolute minimum, 24 square in the scheme, it just doesn't look right. And so I think we're all on the same page. We are doing what we can with these, with an advice clause and with the cladding of the extra two windows, but I can't possibly reject this knowing that only on two grounds we would be going to, would be facing an appeal, which under all circumstances it looks very clear that we would not have a leg to stand on and would come at a significant cost to this council in trying to defend that. So as much as it sits uncomfortably with me, and I'm sure other people in the room, I'll have to support this, and I hope I've spoken for long enough.
That's all right. I'll make a contribution now. Thank you. There are other councillors who haven't spoken, and certainly it would be great to hear from everybody in relation to their views on this. I think it's important for members of the community to understand that as councillors, when we sit as a planning authority, that we do, this is something that does create a fair amount of angst for us because of the planning laws that we need to assess the proposals that come before us under, and it can be very difficult at times. But I also want to assure the community that the representations that are provided to us, that we do read them wholly in their entirety, and I have a great deal of sympathy for the people who have made the representations. I think there have been some very thorough ones provided to us. I perhaps take a slightly different view than some of my colleagues around the table here, and this will surprise probably my fellow councillors, because I have always maintained that when you sit as a planning authority that you need to assess this against the scheme, and I believe that in this case we can get around the situation of the assessment that's been made, because I don't feel on face value that this is going to be a for all intents and purposes a usual family home, because of the highly unusual situation with the bedrooms, the large number of bathrooms, the ancillary unit and so on. So I have asked staff to prepare an alternative recommendation, and the alternative recommendation is one of refusal, and it's based on the following grounds. And I did circulate this around to only a little while ago to councillors, and Mrs. Morton has it as well, if she could just bring it up on the screen, because I do want to test the waters before I'm not... Obviously, I can't move this from the chair. I would have to vacate the chair to move this, but I want to foreshadow that I believe that we could defend this on the grounds that, or refuse it on the grounds that it is designed with use other than a single dwelling, and therefore it doesn't meet the number of car parking spaces that it has been, that it would require as something that is not just a single dwelling. The issue of the private open space that we have already discussed, I believe that we could put that forward as a reason for refusal, but also the issue of the windows that we have also discussed. So, as I said, I can't move this from the chair. I want to test the waters to see if there's anybody who would like to move this, or whether it is... So is there anybody who has an appetite to move this? And I stress that this is obviously an amendment that I've asked the planning staff to prepare. So if we were to go down this path, then that would be the basis of the defence of this if it ended up in the tribunal. Councillor Antoli.
Right. I was going to ask a question. I think you partially answered that. That's point A. That's defendable, because I was getting opposite reasonings earlier from the staff.
Ms. Tolman.
Because we asked about parking and we were told repeatedly that the parking is adequate, so I'm not
sure.
It is
adequate if it's assessed as a single residential building, but I'm suggesting that we don't take that on face value. And in that case, if it was being used as a boarding house or a communal residence, then the parking isn't adequate. So my premise is not taking it on face value that it will be a single dwelling, because I don't believe that...
I'm sympathetic, but how defendable is that we can't take it on face value?
Ms. Tylemore.
Through you, Mayor, the recommendation of the planning team is as per the council report. We're requested to prepare this alternative recommendation, and that's the strongest argument we can offer.
I also have issues in relation to the question of overshadowing and the question of the question of enforcement. If this turns out not to be operating as a family home, well, it's still being built then. It's not like an enforcement is going to... An enforcement could say, well, you're not allowed to have, you know, X number of people. You can't have 25 people living there and 10 cars. The situation is the house will already be built, and it is highly unlikely that a tribunal would ask the house to be knocked down. So that's why, to me, the argument about enforcement, if it's not used as it's been stated, is kind of irrelevant. Councillor Antoli.
Are we allowed to move to discuss? Is that permitted?
Yep, you can give me a procedural move.
Well, I'd like, since you asked, this is a big move, and it could cost us. And I think the majority of the room is somewhat sympathetic, but I think we need to discuss it, so I'd like to move to discuss, please.
Thank you. Do I have a seconder to discuss? Okay, the motion is that the matter be discussed, moved by Councillor Antoli and seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you.
All those in favour. Sorry,
aye.
Thank you.
Aye.
Aye. Against? Motion is carried. We're now in discussion, so anybody who has spoken previously can speak. Start with Councillor Antoli.
Yeah, I think I've... I am sympathetic towards it. I just want to make sure that we don't get taken to the cleaners at court, and I would love to get some feedback from some of my peers who are a bit more learned in this space than I am, or some thoughts. Cue Councillor Street.
Okay, Councillor Cordo. I think Councillor Richardson actually had his light on next, and then so I'll go to Councillor Richardson, and then Councillor Cordova had his light on. Councillor Street looks reluctant, but we'll come to him. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Whilst I agree in principle with what you said, and in my view it's clearly designed to be more than a family home, also noting there's a kitchen sink in the upstairs lounge room, I am very reluctant to set a precedent where we refuse developments that meet the standard against the advice of staff, because we have suspicions or we don't agree with the development. I think that's across the board a dangerous precedent to set, and something that I have personally fought against. So we find ourselves in a position where I think we can all say that this is absolutely not something we would choose to have in this location, in this community, but it is also a very unfortunate situation that we are somewhat snookered. And I think to A, set the precedent to deny it based on our feelings, and B, put our council in the position where we may be having to defend a dubious denial in Tascat and cost ourselves money, is not a course of action I'm prepared to support at this point.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. Next I had Councillor Cordova, then Glade Wright, then Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Similarly, I think the reason why this foreshadowed motion is potentially, I think it's too risky. I think it's a potentially costly move, and the reason I think that is because we had an application not for a commercial venture, we had an application for a single dwelling in the general residential zone, and we're basically calling into question that intention, and it's really a line ball as to whether somebody makes the argument, well, some people do like a seven-bedroom house with seven bathrooms, and that's their prerogative to have a single dwelling in a general residential zone. It's a line ball, and I don't claim to be able to predict what Tascat would say. I just think that's a significantly risky move to gamble on Tascat falling falling towards our perception rather than falling towards somebody else's perception, which is that people can build a development in a housing development area that suits their taste as long as it falls within the planning scheme, which the advice is that this does. So I think it's too risky. If someone gets approval for a single dwelling in a general residential zone and then they start operating as a nightclub, as a terrible example, then enforcement action...
Please don't wish that upon them.
No, of course not. But then enforcement action would take place, and it's incumbent on the council to act on that and to trigger those enforcements and to rectify the situation. So there are examples that I can think of where that has happened before, where dwellings were being used inappropriately or against the permits for which they were issued, and emergency action can take place where the CEO or the general manager can enforce that. So in the specific example I'm thinking was actually provided by, well, one of many examples, but it was provided by one of the representors about a case in Shearwater in 2014, which I think all the councillors have access to, that case where a dwelling was being used inappropriately, and then Latrobe Council stepped in and stopped them from doing that. So I think it's a bridge too far to preempt that, to assume that somebody is going to do the wrong thing or behave in a way that is a non-permitted use. I think it's a bridge too far. It's a very risky gamble that we would be taking, I believe, to follow this foreshadowed amendment.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Next I had Councillor Gladright.
Thank you. I share the reasoning that has already been mentioned by Councillor Cordova and Councillor Richardson. I also just wanted to speak to what a family home is. I know I've got friends who are African. They have African families have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids. So their family home will be quite a bit larger. I know families who are considering using dwellings for multi-generational purposes, to have mum and dad come in and live with them, and then as the young kids get older that they can have areas in a house as well. So this idea of what a family home should be, I think, is not, necessarily has to be in line with what else is on Hollyhock Drive. I think a family home can come in many different shapes and forms, and maybe culturally a family home is quite different, and that's allowed in Australia. This proposal is meeting the planning scheme. We've addressed the concerns of the neighbours, we've moved amendments to put on the extra screening. I don't feel comfortable supporting this amendment. I'm happy to stay with the advice of the planners.
Thank you. Councillor Street, you were next on my list, but you need to put your light on.
I turned it off because I was being useful. Look, I agree with the things that have been said in opposition to this proposed amendment. It gives me no great pleasure and joy in approving or voting to approve a development application of this nature, given the concerns of the surrounding residents. But the reality is that we cannot assess this application based on supposition and presumption. We can only assess it on the basis of what's been put before us. And in any event, the advice that I am hearing, and it's my own view on review of the matter as well, is that it really matters very little apart from in terms of the parking and access code as to what the declared use is. And in any event, we can only assess it on the use that's been requested. I don't necessarily agree that that enforcement action won't be effective after construction if it's taken in relation to a non-approved use. Again, another thing that is always difficult for us to separate out is this question of use and development. The development will have occurred, but the use can still change later on, and if the use isn't in accordance with the development approval, then we can enforce that and request that the property only be used for the use that's been approved, or otherwise permitted. So I don't necessarily agree that because the tribunal won't order the property to be knocked down or altered, enforcement action won't be effective. Like I said, it doesn't give me any joy to do this when there are so many residents around and representations against a development application, but we can only assess what we have before us within the terms of the planning scheme, and I do not think that there is any reason for us to refuse the application on any of those bases.
Thank you. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have nothing further to add other than those agree with what those who've spoken against this amendment you've put forward. I agree with what's been said, and thank you, Mayor, for trying to have a look at, I guess, a compromise and a different outlook on this. But as I said, I agree with what the first proposal, what the officers have put forward in assessing against the planning scheme, but also just want to acknowledge the stress that it has caused for many of the surrounding neighbours, the uneasiness. Home is our home, it's our place where we go at the end of the day, we want to feel safe, where our children play, we raise a family. So I just acknowledge that it has caused, I'm sure, a lot of stress for the surrounding neighbours.
Thank you. If there's no further contributions on the discussion, then we'll move back into the substantive motion. So I've got a long list here of those who have already spoken. We've got an amended motion. Are there any further contributions?
Question.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is about the advice clause, the drafting of the advice clause suggested by Councillor Antoli.
Yep. Sure. Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the Councillor Antoli asked about it worded for a condition as well, so I've written it as if it's a condition, can easily convert it to an advice clause, written on the fly, so hopefully, and it probably needs a contribution about what the expectation is of what's there. But drafted it as if it was a 1C, so the first two conditions asked for the screening on the windows, B asked for the landscape plan, which was just a repetition of one of the other conditions, that's why it's in there. And then we would have a letter C, and I suggest the wording is attached, comma, non-reflective, comma. Oh no, no comma after the non-reflective. Feel free to correct my English on this. non-reflective screening or finishes, bracket, i.e. painting or cladding, close bracket, using muted tones to soften the external appearance of the shipping container, of the shipping containers, comma, where visible from outside the site. given I'm not sure what the expectation of the councillors are, whether they were talking about screening attached to the fence, which can sometimes be problematic, although they wanted screening of the shipping container, and are the residents going to be satisfied that I'll be making a decision whether it's appropriate or not? Because if they do purple stripes, is that okay? That's where we've added the word in muted tones, which frustrates some people. We said non-reflective for obvious reasons, even though it is south-facing, so it shouldn't be. The site is visible when it talks about the outside of the site. That would mean the adjoining property to the south as well as the reserve to the rear. And then a decision needs to be made if it's visible from the street because you can see it down the driveway. So it would end up being the whole lot. That's a suggested wording.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Councillor
Ntoli. Yeah,
yep.
Thank you.
Is that acceptable to the mover and the seconder of the motion so that it becomes part of the recommendation? So we had Councillor Gladewright as the mover. It's a condition. Ms. Tullamore.
The question, when I initially answered the question, I'd said that it was an advice clause. Councillor Ntoli asked if it could be drafted as a condition, so the decision has been made by the elected members whether they want it as a condition or an advice clause. If it's an advice clause, we would just need to add to the start of that, it is recommended that, and take out the word attached, and it would need to go down to the bottom. But it's not enforceable if it's an advice clause. It's only enforceable if it's a condition of the permit.
Can I ask a question?
And both are appealable.
Who said, can I ask a question? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. My question is about the... Both are appealable, one being the advice clause is technically unenforceable, but it provides advice, whereas a condition is mandatory, so to speak, in order to enact the permitted... in order to enact the permit. My question is, when it comes to appeals, are we putting a higher... I guess, is it a higher burden, so to speak, or is it a... Is it more likely that things will get appealed if you try and enforce a condition rather than an advice clause? Will it trigger... How does TASCAT view a condition as opposed to an advice clause?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, so it would be really unlikely the applicant would appeal an advice clause because they can just choose to ignore it. Obviously, we've got many instances where people... have a genuine interest and are committed to their community and will happily do it because they know it's going to appease the neighbours. They're going to live amongst the community, so they might do it. Would the tribunal take issue with it? They probably wouldn't even hear the matter about an advice clause. They would have to hear the appeal on this condition if the applicant were to appeal it or if the representatives were to appeal it because they don't like the condition or any other part of the permit, they'd need to consider it. As I mentioned previously, I believe that it is beyond the requirements of the planning scheme and there's not a real need for it. Now, that's not on any personal preference about shipping containers. It's just that it's not triggering a performance criteria assessment on it.
So my follow-up question is that to that extent it is... it's almost like an opinion or a bit arbitrary because we're not responding here to any performance criteria or advice clause. We're basically just adding something in because it feels right to do so. So my next question then is, anywhere else in Kingston, Margate, Blackmans Bay, highly developed general residential areas, have we ever required a similar condition where muted tones are required? You know, because I acknowledge that on Bruny Island where there's landscape... zoning, for example, that's where we do it, but do we ever do it in built-up suburban residential areas like Kingston, Blackmans Bay, Margate?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, yes, we do. So general residential zoning may still have codes that affect it, such as the scenic landscape over code, or we may do it where it doesn't comply with the standards. So as an example, if this building was taller and outside the building envelope, these outbuildings were taller and outside the envelope, then we may have justification to say that they need to incorporate landscaping, or they may need to do a certain treatment, or extend the fence to soften the appearance of that built form, because the performance criteria sends you to that. It sends you to consider the impact of the bulk and the appearance of the building, but that hasn't occurred in this instance. So yes, it does occur in residential areas. Yes, we do use it in other permits where there's a nexus to the requirements of the planning scheme.
Councillor, a question on this.
Dean, yep, and then I would actually, we do need to ask the mover and seconder if they accept this, but I'll allow you a question and then we'll move to that.
Sorry, yep, thank you very much. I'm not sure if the question should be really, has it happened elsewhere, because there's obviously codes and overlays that you've mentioned. My question is really, if we include it as a condition, what is the likelihood, not a likelihood, but what is the potential process for the applicant to appeal? Because obviously you pointed out we pretty much don't have a leg to stand on this one. We've just, it's beyond our reach somewhat because it doesn't trigger anything within the scheme. What would happen if they just were going to go, no, we're not going to go with that? What would be the, I guess, the process or result for us as a council?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor. Just firstly, the reference to not leg a stand on are your words, not mine. I just want to make that clear that I'm not being overly over the top on that. What is the process for them to appeal? They may choose to appeal any of the conditions that are in there, whether it's condition 6 or 3 or anything. The process they go through is they make a written application to the tribunal. It's a form. They pay a fee to do that. It goes to the tribunal. They notify us. We send them all the basic information. And then we proceed to a preliminary conference, where all parties go. We talk about the dates and what experts and how many days we might need for the appeal. Will we entertain mediation? We, as local litigants, always encourage mediation where it's possible, and so the representors, the neighbours, can choose to be parties to the appeal. And we would say to people that it's probably better to be part of the appeal than not, because decisions can be made and they don't need to go back and ask you about it. So that they can, something might change in this proposal. They say, oh, okay, you can put another story on the building and you're not part of that, so it's better that they're part of that appeal. And they also then get to have some contribution and tell the tribunal how it affects them. It's an important part of it. And then that mediation, it may be discussed, well, you know, would everyone be happy if we moved the shipping container 500 mil that way or a metre that way, or we get rid of one container and keep one, or we get rid of the containers altogether and put up a zinc loom outbuilding. So they're the sorts of things that can happen at the mediation. Only if everyone consents that we would then write to the tribunal and say, we all consent and these are our new conditions that we consent on, and then the tribunal must make a decision about whether they have the jurisdiction to do it. Involves us telling them whether they've got jurisdiction to do it, which is unusual. And then they will make a decision, and if they think it's too far, then they may not approve it, or if we don't read mediation, we will go to a full hearing. And the representatives can choose to represent themselves. They can employ someone to represent them. They can all pull their money together to get a representative to do that. We offer the service of explaining what the process is, how it works, give some sort of indication about, well, there's no point trying to push it on this because you're not going to get it. We provide that regardless of whether the decision is against us or not, or the appeal is against us or not, we will provide that. The developer can also self-represent. Usually they would get a representative, and council would be present at the appeal as well.
Councillor Antoli,
I'd like this to be. I don't know if this is a question, but I'd like this to be a condition.
Okay. So I need to ask first the mover and the seconder to indicate whether this is acceptable, because that'll determine how we treat this clause in a discussion moving forward. So, Councillor Wade-Wright is the mover.
I don't support it as a condition. I think it's far too onerous.
Okay.
There's no reason in the scheme for it to be a condition.
All right.
I'm happy for it to be an advice. Can I speak to my reasoning why I don't support it?
Oh, sorry. I'm very conscious of our time. Keep going. Sorry. I beg your pardon.
Thank you. As far as I can see, the applicants of this site have listened to submissions and made compromises I feel confident that if they see this as an advice, that they will take that information and use it wisely. I think that there's not enough reason to have it from the planning scheme point of view as a condition, but I'd be happy with it as an advice.
Okay. So, right. So there's only one way to proceed. Well, there's several ways to proceed with this now. We either, somebody would need to move C as a, for it to be a condition if they felt strongly about it, I'd need a mover and a seconder for that. Or, as the mover of the original motion has indicated that she would be open to it being moved to being an advisory, part of the advice clauses, we can go down that path. Is there anybody who would like to see it, move an amendment to see it as a condition of the permit? If you can just indicate that to me. Yeah? Okay. Okay, I've got a mover and Councillor Antoli. Have we got a seconder? I can't second it from the chair. Okay. So that lapses as a having it in there. So the proposal now is that it move to be a one of the advice clauses. So if you can just pop that down as the last advice clause, so it becomes G, and the wording would be exactly the same.
I'm happy to second that if Councillor Antoli wants to move it.
So, no, because it's acceptable to the mover of the original motion and the seconder. Could you just indicate? Yes, thanks, Councillor Midgley. Okay. So it now moves to be part of the advice clauses, and that's accepted by the mover and seconder of the motion. So we're back on the substantive motion, which has got that change as well as the change of the windows. Is there anybody else who hasn't made a substantive contribution? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I have questions that I've been waiting to ask on this one. So just in regards, some questions about the recommendations. So the recommendation 2, page 19 at the bottom there, so it says any alterations in the main dwelling, creating a separate self-contained multi-unit, etc., will not be permitted without further approvals from council. Just for the surrounding residents and the public, what does that further approval mean?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, you'd need to come back and get a planning permit.
Thank you. Same for recommendation 7, the ancillary dwelling must not be used for visitor accommodation without prior consent of council. And I guess, would that be, you know, the yellow sign at the front kind of advertised that way in regards to if it was to be used for a visitor accommodation?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, potentially it would be a permitted application, which means that it doesn't go to advertising. So you may need a planning permit, but not be advertised, because it wouldn't be a discretionary use because of the state government bringing in PD6, which makes those permitted. Also, if it was used as visitor accommodation because they're away on vacation, their words, it can be used in that way without needing a planning permit as well, but that's just occasional use.
Thank you. And recommendation 3 regarding the shipping container. So the second paragraph, the shipping containers must not be used for separate self-contained residential purposes and for any commercial or industry activity at any time without the written consent of council. So say, for example, if the shipping container was used for an industrial activity and the surrounding neighbours found that out, I'm sure they can email council and let them know about it. But in regards to that being permitted, would such any of those sort of industries or commercial, etc., be permitted?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, if it was, you can have home occupations which must meet the home occupation clauses of the planning scheme, so you can have some home occupation style commercial use in there, but a proper industrial use, defined proper industrial use, but a offensive industrial use is prohibited in general residential zone anyway, and there's a lot of limitations around commercial uses in general residential zone as well.
just before I ask if there's any other questions, just following on from Councillor Midgley's question about 7C not to be used for visitor accommodation without prior consent of council. If the ancillary unit, if there was an application down the track for the ancillary unit to be converted to visitor accommodation, what would the situation be with parking then? Because surely they couldn't meet the parking requirements of visitor accommodation, given there's only three parking spaces for the entire premises anyway.
The proposal for a visitor accommodation would need to be assessed against the provisions of E6 for car parking. I'd have to look up to see what the requirement is for visitor parking and whether it's one is satisfied, because if there's three on site, then they do have one spare. I can look that up. But
that's right.
Being mindful of making the decision on this application, not speculation.
Sorry, it was just a question if that becomes an issue. Are there any further questions or contributions? Councillor Antoli.
I don't have a contribution, I have a question about process. What about the amendment that you, the change that you had proposed, you're not going ahead with that? Is that what you...
To refuse the refusal?
Yes, that one.
Well, there was no appetite for a second.
Right, so, okay. I wasn't sure if there was a process.
I can't move it from the chair, so right. I was seeking somebody else to move it. There was no right. appetite for that, so...
I didn't know if we'd closed the loop on that on process
sorry.
Or not.
Yep.
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
Okay, are there any further discussions? Councillor Bain.
Sorry, just one last question. Are we allowed to give some advice to those who have put in representation about what the process is if they want to appeal it?
Yes, so Ms Tyler-Moore has already indicated in her an answer about 10 minutes ago that we would provide advice in relation to any appeal processes, and that's whether it goes against the recommendation that staff have made or otherwise.
And prior to putting in an appeal, are they able to come to council officers and get some advice prior to making that decision?
I believe so, yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any further discussions? I'll just before I hand back to Councillor Gladewright to sum up before we vote, can I just thank all councillors for their contributions on this, because it's certainly been a very long debate, but a worthwhile one where we have explored every sort of avenue that we possibly can. So I thank you all for those contributions. Councillor Gladewright, to sum up? No sum up? Sorry, Councillor Fox, you missed.
I haven't spoken, but I've really listened carefully to the debate, and I guess one thing I'm pleased about is that we haven't put a condition that wouldn't be upheld by the planning scheme, because I think we'd be in danger of having costs awarded against council. But I think we've come up with a reasonable compromise with what we've done, and I do support the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Gladewright doesn't wish to sum up, so I'm going to put the recommendation now. It's moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. The Planning Authority session now adjourns at 7:07 p.m. I might call a short recess, but we've got quite a bit still to get through. So if we could just have a 10-minute break and be back here at 7:22, that would be great. Thank you. I couldn't do the maths on that. Stop the tape. All right. Welcome back. For those who are watching along at home, apologies, we just needed a quick break after quite an intensive debate, and we are now back and we are on. We're in the open session of Council that has recommenced. We're on page 46, petitions still being actioned, there are none, and at the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions have been received. Takes us to officers' reports to council, and we're on Copping Refuse Disposal Site, Joint Authority Proposed Rule Changes, recommendation on page 48. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. A mover and Councillor Cordova. and a secondary Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordoga.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a very straightforward and prosaic rule change, and the idea here, basically there's a set of processes that need to be undertaken in order for the Copping Refuse Disposal Site Joint Authority to change their rules, and so basically they have to ask all the ownership councils to approve. The main reason for this is basically to give them the option to separate the roles of authority secretary and the board secretary. So currently those roles are the one and the same person, but they want the option to have a separate secretary for the authority as for the board. That will give them greater capacity to do the work that they do, and really they're just asking for us to approve of the decision that's already been made by them to separate those two roles, or to at least give them the option to separate them. They don't have to if they don't want to, but they're just asking for that option. So I see no risk in and indeed 8.1 of this report says there are no risks identified in this recommendation, so I would ask us to all acquiesce to this recommendation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Councillor Street, it's one of your favourite topics, isn't it?
It is. It's not. I will happily acquiesce, but just make the point that this is like the third set of straightforward and prosaic changes that have been made to the Copping Joint Authority's rules in the last 3 years. They are an absolute pain because of the provisions of the Local Government Act, and instead of coming back every year, perhaps it might be time for the board of the authority to put some money into reviewing their constitution and rules to get them right for the next 5 or 10 years, rather than having to go through this process, which requires it to come back to us 3 times, I think, and then to every other member council as well, 3 times, and then advertised. Something for you to take back to the board.
Thank you, Councillor Street. I'm sure Councillor Cordova will pass that along. Any further discussion? I'm assuming there's no summing up then. So I'll put the recommendation as printed on page 48. Moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 60, Draft Margate Master Plan. With a recommendation on page 62, I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Antoli and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. It's with pleasure that I put forward this draft Margate Master Plan to Council for approval. In 14 days from now, Margate will be my family's new home.
Oh.
And we're moving from Kingston to Margate. And so we've read this with interest. This Master Plan is a target, not a road, not a Google Maps of everything that will happen, but it is based on extensive community consultation that happened over a period of on two different occasions. In February 24, on the 12th, no, we had 1,000 responses, which is huge, on the 12th of Feb to the 12th of March, and then there was a community workshop held on the 20th. And feedback from the community has been implemented in the plan, and I just would love to note to the community, we would love to be able to put everything in the plan into our reality, but council can't guarantee that, and it's based on a target rather than a step-by-step roadmap where everything will be done. So we just have to manage community consultation on that. I want to thank council staff for the extensive work that they put into this. The community workshop work, the after-hours work, the phone calls, all of that, and it looks pretty good to me. And it was also done professionally with the help of external provider, and I recommend it to the council for approval.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a great privilege to second this motion, and I agree with Councillor Antoli's sentiments regarding the funding requirements for this. I think one of the real advantages of having a plan on a page that is well thought out, that's visionary, that is a bold and audacious goal, that then allows you to receive funding or to at least seek funding, because you already have some shovel-ready ideas for projects that could go in. Without those plans on a page, what it, it's very difficult to seek and receive funding from state government and federal government. So you really do need to have done the legwork already, and I think that's one of the chief advantages of having this draft master plan here, is what it will enable the council to do is show this visionary and to some extent audacious document. It does have a lot of really exciting but bold and what will be expensive things to implement. And so, as Councillor Antolli alluded to, it's not like on day one we'll be able to fund all this, but what it does give us is the plan to be able to show funding bodies and authorities to say, well, we have all these great ideas for Margate. They're not just our ideas, but they are born out of community consultation. They're born out of key stakeholders like the local school. We've talked to people about what their issues are, about traffic, about wanting to make the landscape, make the urban built environment look nicer, help people to, as Stephen Burgess would say, stop, stick, stay and spend. You know, how do you attract people into your commercial business areas and have them not just stop off for 5 minutes, grab a coffee and then leave, but how do you make it attractive and pleasant enough for people to want to meet friends and spend a bunch of money and go to a bunch of different shops and you know, meet people and bring the family? How do you encourage that kind of a urban amenity? So this has all that, and it was born from community consultation. So I think we're doing this in the right way. And so even if on day one we aren't able to fund every aspect of this, or indeed many aspects of this, it will open many doors, I hope, for funding opportunities. So I do endorse the draft Margate Master Plan.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, echo all that's been said. And thanks to the many people who have taken part in the consultation. Without their voice, we can't get to the draft master plan as it is. We know it's a really important corridor for Kingborough. It's outside of, you know, Kingston, where we've done a lot of work over the last kind of 5 years. Now we're looking to the suburbs outreaching to Kingborough. We know that it's a route that tourists use on their way to Bruny Island, and we know with the increased population in Kingborough that, you know, Margate is facing some congestion sort of problems as well. And the new development there, we'll see a new kind of look for Margate. So it's really in line with that. Members of the community have spoken about that, the street and the traffic and the safe crossing as well. So noting as well, in 4.9, the plan staff and the consultants have spoken with DSG. And other stakeholders, and concept proposals have been identified as quick wins, stepping stones or big move wins kind of thing as well. And there was also a point around which has been really raised by the public, and definitely you know, raised as an important matter during when councillors were door knocking for the elections, around the investigating opportunities to improve pedestrian safety and public transport infrastructure. So that's sort of alongside this report as well. So I guess I just got a question around, like, where to now? What happens? Does this draft kind of concept then go back out to the community? What does that kind of look like? We're just sort of getting a bit of a nod, any kind of tweaks and changes, and then it comes back to council. Is that correct?
Mr. Reid.
Yeah, no, that's right. So effectively, like all these master plans or strategies there, we go back to the community there. They've got a bit more of a finished product to have a look at and understand. Particularly, we've sort of made an effort to put it in a one-pager format so they can look at it in either a brief format, or if they have the inclination, they can look into the detail. But that gives them the opportunity to give some input into, or final input, and then we will take that into account before bringing it back as a final plan. I guess in terms of actual works in that area there, DSG is still working on their own work in that space as well, particularly with the pedestrian crossings, which is one of the main things we'd like to see early in the piece. So that work continues. Hopefully after the consultation, we'll have a little bit more clarity in terms of where that's gone, because they're doing their own consultation on that part of it. So that hopefully should be able to be incorporated in our final plan for council consideration.
Great, thank you. And just, yeah, to acknowledge that summary as well for those people who don't have time to read the whole, you know, colour tone and and brick selection that we might be looking at in the future. Mm-hmm. We've got a nice executive sort of summary there for us to have an overview. And I'm thinking as well that it'll go back out because a lot of the council committees had a bit of say in it as well, so the safety and the KBAC and the access and advisory. So hopefully it will go just and acknowledge that they'll be... that, you know, this draft master plan is here and if they want to have an input and if there's any local community groups as well, hopefully they'll be acknowledged about it as well. I think there's a Margate community group. I think it started up, I'm not sure, but yeah.
Thank
out
you.
For it.
Thank you, Councillor Minchley. Councillor Bain and then Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. So the Margate master plan, I think it's been coming for quite a while, so it's great to see here. I think if I remember correctly, we received some feedback during the 23-24 budget consultation. It's actually something that we agreed to add in, so it's good to see the results. As has already been said, it's a very broad plan, incorporates a lot of different elements, which in total will require significant external funding, so it's not something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take many years to develop. However, what I really do like about the plan is it's broken up into the different categories of the quick wins, the stepping stones and the big moves. So as a council, we'll have the ability to tackle the plan in different stages and bit by bit make significant improvements across Margate. And the other thing worth noting is it isn't all just about us, it's also about... it's great to have a master plan that provides guidance for state government, like we've spoken about the crossings, the bus stops, and for commercial and residential developers. So they know that what the council and the community would like to see Margate develop into. So I think it's got a lot of benefits, even though it is quite large. It's aspirational, but hopefully we'll see it all come to pass over the many years. And look forward to seeing the feedback from the community.
Thank you. Councillor Fox.
Thank you. I'm really pleased about the timing of this particular strategy. It's Margate has been growing so rapidly in the last decade or so, and with the new shopping centre coming on board, I think if there are any further developments, we will have the power to sort of direct them to be more in line with the needs of the community to make this area a more livable area, to try and reduce that corridor effect that Councillor Midgley mentioned, where we've got a main road linking Bruny Island and the south of Kingborough through this tiny town with schools on both sides and people desperate to cross the road, and it's almost impossible with cars trying to get out of intersections. Even the Sandfly Road intersection is becoming a nightmare. And I think it's really good that DSG are on board, and I'm hoping that there will be improvements with crossings, because I'm worried that there'll be lives lost before that is actually on the ground. And also that the environmental conditions are taken into account and the area is more livable in general for the local residents. There's such a huge amount of growth that's happened without being seen from the road. All the areas on both sides of the highway have been... hundreds of houses have gone in the last few years, and I think there's going to be more because Kingborough is growing so rapidly, and this is probably one of the major growth areas for us. So it would be a terrible shame if something didn't happen soon as a result of this study, and I think we should focus on that and make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. I just have one question in relation to this. Obviously, like others, I'm pleased to see this here, and as I'm sure the community is, because I know they've been waiting for it for some time. But the other thing they've been waiting for some time is a bus shelter and a bus stop. I did inquire with Mr. Reeve a number of weeks ago as to whether we could put some pressure on the Department of State Growth to... start that, because the Margate bus stop was identified as the third priority out of all the 90 or so that needed to be upgraded to be made accessible and also to have some shelter. And I believe that they were waiting for this master plan to be completed. Do you have an update that you can share, Mr. Reeve? Because I know you tried to contact them and the contact was away, but have you got anything further to report?
Through you, Mayor. Look, I did contact them, and the person who was working on that's moved on to another area there, but I've got the contact for the person who is working on it. They did tell me they were due to start on that, I won't say imminently, but they were due to start on that fairly soon. So what I can do is...
You've had your thesaurus out, haven't you?
I have, yeah. So... So I'll chase that up again with them, because that was probably about a week or two ago. So I'll just see whether or not there's actually been any other movement on there.
Thank you, because I have had, since we did put this out for... since we announced that we were doing this, I have had inquiries from members of the Margate community. Councillor Dean.
Sorry, that was just my question. Is we did the online engagement. We met with, you know, the school and stakeholders. Is there any plan to engage more in person to, I suppose, let the community know, other than plonking on the website?
Mr. Reeve?
Through you, Mayor. We've already actually had some discussions with, for example, Banjos, because there's the council car park that's near there, so they've made them aware of it, and also the school as well. So some of the key stakeholders we've actually gone back to directly already. So I guess the intention with this is to more widely release it to the Margate community there and get their feedback through that avenue. Clearly, during the process there, we've actually done a fairly extensive community consultation to gather people's thoughts. So we're hoping with this final one, plus some of those targeted type consultations there, we'll gather any of the final thoughts we actually need to actually incorporate into the master plan.
Councillor Dean.
Thanks. Yeah, look, the point was really more about kind of spruiking it. You've done a lot of consultation, actually just making them aware that the end product is fantastic. And just one other question, probably for Mr. Reeve. State Growth have finished up their own kind of consultation phase into pedestrian crossings on the main road. Do we have any... Have you heard from them as to how their project is going?
Mr. Reeve.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. So we meet with them generally on a weekly or fortnightly basis, just to make sure the two projects are actually running side by side. So, for example, this project informs where we might have actually identified areas where they would have crossing points. So it's a little bit difficult because, you know, we're running our consultation on a more general type area, because it's a whole master plan, and they're running it more on particular pedestrian crossing points and so forth. So they were lagging us a little bit in terms of that side of things. So I don't know that they've actually come to a final point, if you like, as to where they're going to be at with that. But I'm hoping that while we go through this consultation, this final consultation with the community there, that we'll get some more information back from State Growth on that.
Any further contributions? Councillor Antoli, did you want to sum up? No. I'll put the recommendation then on, as per page 62 of the agenda, moved by Councillor Antoli and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 115, Draft Kingborough Health and Wellbeing Strategy 2024 to 2029, with the recommendation on page 116. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in Councillor Gladright. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Happy to move this health and wellbeing strategy, and noting it's the first one for Kingborough Council to do this. If we look across the Victorian councils, we'll note that I think most of the Victorian councils actually have a health and wellbeing strategy, and I think it's sort of a part of their, you know, some, I don't know if it's legislative or something like that. Don't actually know if that's true, but anyway, when I did have a look to compare other health and wellbeing strategies,
so it sounded true.
It sounded there was something in there, but I didn't quite take it all in. But it looks like a lot of them have them. But noting that across Tasmania, maybe 5 years ago, I think LGAT kind of looked at this health and wellbeing strategies for Tasmanian councils. Again, I don't know the full history of that one, but as you can see, one of the links or a website, I think it's on LGAT or somewhere, you can see that got, like, there's a bit of a movement across Tasmanian councils in regards to actually doing a health and wellbeing strategy. So this health and wellbeing strategy that it was a grant that council staff had applied for, so that's sort of where it's come from in regards to that. And really just acknowledging that, you know, health and wellbeing, it's like we're the closest to the people are, you know, health and wellbeing. Like, it's a really important part of our community, and we've seen that through, you know, many factors of our love of playgrounds, tracks and trails, our response to public health, minimising, you know, no smoking places and things like that. And when we look at, like, the pages, say, the three strategic outcomes, if we look following the detail in that on page 146, the thing that really, made me look at this strategy in comparison to other strategies we have in council is the breadth of, like, council areas that it covers, you know, from the environmental health and climate change and people's well-being in response to that, or the work that staff are doing in there, to, you know, the NRM area, that's again environmental services, but, you know, to engineering, to community services, to just all the areas, like the breadth that this strategy kind of touches, I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, staff, but, you know, I feel like this really does encompass, like, a lot of different areas. And again, there's a part of the document that lists the kind of different strategies that this aligns to. Again, it's like a whole, you know, it's a broad range of things, because that's really what health and wellbeing does. So again, this, the consultation, it came out, I think, during a bit of a busy time during consultation that was happening at council last year, but we did have quite a high number of people participate. And I also note that council was able to sort of have that consultation around some of the other activities that they run. So it really feels like this strategy provides a bit of a sort of roadmap for kind of what council's sort of already doing already, which is a great thing, because it really kind of helps to justify, checks in that we're doing okay, and then kind of gives a bit of a map and a thinking of what areas have we missed and what areas for the future. So that was sort of my bit of a summary of where I thought this strategy aligns to. And again, it's another one that will go out to the community just for a final check-in to make sure that, you know, we did cover kind of everything, what this health and wellbeing means to the community. Then I guess we'll come back to, yeah, council for further endorsement. My only comment on it, it's really fantastic, and I thank the staff for all the effort they've put into this and putting this wealth of information together, is last week, the Mayor's mentioned this as well, I did a plain English workshop with 2610, and I read it and I just think, wow, there's a lot of words. You know, but again, because it's that roadmap for I guess for the council staff to have as well, to ensuring we're working, you know, in the right areas. We just got to have that thing when we're going out to the community that we've, you know, what bits are they going to read of it, what bits are they going to kind of take from it, and things like that. So that's really my only kind of comment. But then when I looked across a few other Victorian councils and some other ones across Tasmania, it's very similar. So that's just, I think, you know, that's just what government likes to do, really. But, yeah, thanks to all the staff involved. It's great to have this wellbeing strategy, and I look forward to comments as it comes back to us in the future.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. The Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. Thanks, Councillor Midgley. I won't echo everything again. I just had a question. Has all of the grant money been expended already, or is there any left over for implementation?
Mr. Fuji.
Through you, Mayor. The grant money was for only for developing the plan or the strategy, so we actually can't use it for implementation, and it's now expired as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Further contributions. I just wanted to thank the staff for the preparation of this. I thought it was a very good... I thought the number of people, nearly 500 people who engaged with this was, even though it did come at a busy time, I think there's obviously a lot of appetite in the community to want to discuss health and wellbeing issues. I did just want to make a point that on page 131, there's a table here on 4.2, how do you rate your health? Poor, fair, good, very good and excellent. There's no... There's no tag along the bottom to explain what the different colours are on the table. So it's not clear to me what the blue, the brown, and the green actually means. So that's just an omission there that we might want to resolve before it goes out for comment. I guess, as Councillor Midgley said, I think it's quite interesting that we have multiple roles within the community for, you know, what is our, whilst all levels of government are responsible for health and wellbeing, we have multiple ones. We have ones as a provider, we have ones as a regulator where we regulate public health things like food safety. We're a facilitator of, you know, healthy environments. We're an advocate for our community when it comes to health and wellbeing, and we partner with organisations. So we have quite a large role to play in the health and wellbeing space. And I think that this is an excellent strategy, and I welcome the community to feedback to us whether they think we need to make any amendments to it, and I really thank council staff for their work in relation to this. Are there any further discussions? Councillor Midgley, did you want to sum up? I'll put the recommendation then, moved by Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Gladewright. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Takes us to appendices on page 154. Are there any questions or comments in relation to the appendices? No. We will move on then. I do need a mover and a seconder that they be noted. I've got a mover in Councillor Street, a seconder in Councillor Gladewright. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Notices of motion, there were no notices of motion, and confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session, confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence. So I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Mover in Councillor Fox, seconder in Councillor Bain. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. That brings us to the end of the open session of Council. So to all those people who have been watching along at home, thank you very much for your presence tonight. That ends the open session of Council, which will adjourn at 7:48, and in accordance with Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Good evening.